Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Today we're going to talk about Queen Elizabeth I.
Very famous queen.
Of England.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of her?
I think it's come across my readings at some point, yes. She was the frozen queen.
So she lived from the 7th of September, 1533, to the 24th of March, 1603. Which overlaps with quite a few of our fellows here. So she was the Queen of England and Ireland from the 17th of November, 1558. That's an important date, but hold on, until her death, so until 1603. She's sometimes called the Virgin Queen, or Gloriana, or Good Queen Bess, from Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so she's kind of famously she was childless her whole life. She never had kids. And she was the fifth and last monarch of the Tudor dynasty. And even more famously, perhaps, as famously, she was the daughter of Henry VIII by his second wife, Anne Boleyn. And Anne Boleyn was executed 2.5 years after Elizabeth's birth. So she never really knew her mother. And so, Henry VIII had 6 wives. What, 4 of them were killed or something? One of them died
And she's a product of this union, and Travis, and I think that one thing that she's brought into this world under a great deal of drama, that never stopped. She was such an influential figure throughout not only during England's reign throughout the world, but also worldwide. She made such an impact.
Oh yeah, yep, and yeah. So she did have an interesting life even before her coronation. Because her half-sister Mary reigned for a while. And during that time, Elizabeth was imprisoned for nearly a year, basically on suspicion of supporting Protestant rebels. And, a lot of this was like conspiracy theories and, to make sure her sister doesn't, rise to power.
Much like throughout the course of Europe, there's a power play between the Catholics and the Protestants. And this was in her backyard as well, thanks to her dad.
Yeah, this was...
Right?
Exactly. So there were... Yeah, at the time there was like Protestant reformers that wanted to go in extreme ends, like the Puritans and that kind of thing. And then there was, the staunch Catholics I don't want to get into the whole history of it because there's a lot of background here.
Right.
But Henry VIII basically wanted a divorce. In fact, he wanted like 5 of them, basically. And the Pope wouldn't grant him. So they broke with the church. And for Henry VIII, it might have been that simple. Like, I just want a divorce, and the Pope won't give it to me, so screw the Pope.
Because he needed a male heir,
but,
right?
But Elizabeth was kind of, was brought up differently and kind of did lend some of the Protestant reformers an ear here and there, and definitely not on the extreme end of things. Definitely not. She didn't have much in common with the Puritans and that kind of thing, but... Yeah, in any case, if you guys want to hear more about the background, she's covered in several other podcasts. There's, English history podcasts and British history podcasts or history of England, whatever. They might have not gotten that far yet in their shows.
But if they do, they'll do her justice because they're great shows. And I think that she's such an influential part of that empire.
Go watch the show The Tudors, which is, of course, fictionalized to a great degree.
Well, the two movies that came out on Elizabeth.
And,
those are great.
Yeah. More than that, there's even
later,
but many movies about on her, and but in case it's still none of this is ringing a bell, she's the one that reigned during the famous victory of Spain of the Spanish Armada that
right.
Kind of probably more to do with weather than actually warfare.
Weather and ammunition that was not appropriate for the cannons on the Spanish ships.
Yeah, okay.
And,
yeah.
Right. So, and other people would call it providence, religious providence.
Right.
They survive. Yeah. So there's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on there. Right. Again, you know, that's a whole other topic. And then a whole other topic is that she reigned in the time of Shakespeare. So, and this was kind of towards the end of her reign. But just a lot of, not just Shakespeare, but a lot of like English literature in general and arts and that kind of thing flourished in and after her time. Even though she wasn't really much of a patron of the arts, actually.
One thing that really stands out to me, and I think this will vet itself out as we go forward in her connection to alchemy in this podcast, is that no one could really mess around with her too much. She held her own in her court. She figured out how to grow into her position, and once she figured how to play the game, mm-hmm. she was in.
Yeah, in fact, so that, you know, if we say 58 to 1603, that's something like 44 years,
yeah.
minus a little, or plus a little. For a monarch in those times, like, I mean those times as in, like, it was tumultuous, you know, the middle of the, or the aftermath of the Reformation, or during the Reformation, you know, all kinds of events happening, everybody trying to wage war at her at some point, and the whole time, and even more so, that imagine if you're a monarch and you never have any heir, no line of succession. So she famously, you know, never married. And she still managed to hold on to power. You know, no one managed to oust her. There was all kinds of conspiracy theories and you know, attempts to oust her. And yeah, it just never happened. So.
Well, you know, you can draw some correlations with, you know, Elizabeth's unmarried status, the fact that she was called the Virgin Queen, to kind of give her some kind of cult status, as we know in the cult of Mary in the Christian belief system. There's kind of that elevation of someone that has got that purity, that's able to be a woman of mark. And she really had that in a lot of ways. You know, in 1559, she told the Commons, the House of Commons, that is, that, "And in the end, this shall be for me sufficient, that a marble stone shall declare that a queen, having reigned for such a time, lived and died a virgin," unquote. All right?
Yeah.
So later on, poets and writers took this up, this theme, and became, you know, really kind of gravitated to this iconography that exalted Elizabeth to these high heights.
They would, yeah. So, they might depict her as, like, as a virgin, or even as some sort of goddess, or,
you know, warrior queen too, at times.
Yeah, just
right?
not as a mere mortal woman. Mm-hmm. She would be, you know, elevated to, you know, beyond just being a queen, but like being some supernatural being. It is interesting that she is kind of a public relations campaign to kind of put a positive spin on this. Yeah, so she would say things like she was married to her kingdom and subjects. She, like, a quote from her is like, if she spoke to the population, she would say, like, "To all my husbands, my good people," you know, as if like everybody's right. She's married to the people, you know.
Well, she had suitors, though. There's a lot of guys that really wanted to marry this woman, you know, and that includes a long list that would even I think one of the tops of the list, to my surprise, is Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah.
Right? Could you imagine that guy proposing marriage? That's interesting.
Yeah. Ivan the IV. There's a great stuff on him on the Russian Rulers podcast. Yeah, that is really interesting, though. That did kind of stand out to me, too. I didn't even know they reigned at the same time. So
right.
Like, oh, Ivan did. Because Russia is such a different state at that time. And I'm like, oh, that's okay.
Right.
That's interesting.
Well, you know, one thing that I really picture Elizabeth doing is being really invested in the new world, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that...
Well, remember we talked about John Dee?
Right.
So we're going to bring him up again, but so the first time anybody mentioned British Empire was John Dee.
Yeah.
And John Dee was interested in navigation. In John Dee's podcast, we kind of mentioned that John Dee put Elizabeth I in the role of this kind of Arthurian... I don't know, like almost legendary status that like she needs to go out and conquer her empire. Like she has the divine right of...
We use that in the United States. It's called manifest destiny.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so you had that. So this is important too. I mean, you talk about Sir Walter Raleigh. You talk about the you know, the explorers that went out there to places that we know today as Virginia, right? Named after the Virgin Queen, for the state of Virginia, or the colony of Virginia.
I wonder if that's common knowledge.
Yeah, people in Virginia, I think, yes. But for the most part, Virginia, we have an idea that today Virginia is in the middle Atlantic. It's kind of an odd shape that leads into West Virginia and Kentucky. But back in the day, Virginia was a huge chunk of everything from almost Pennsylvania all the way on out to Ohio. That was called Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was a huge part of land that was named after the Virgin Queen Elizabeth. But one thing that really kind of gravitates to me in my thought, if I could be a fly on the wall to see this, would be to see the effects of what was brought back from this colony of Virginia for the first time, i.e. tobacco. Mm-hmm. All right? Could you imagine someone saying, now, Your Majesty, this is something that you smoke, that we've seen people smoke, and this is going to be a cash crop. Because once you try it, it's fantastic, and you want more. And it would give her a smoke of tobacco, to the point where she was smoking it quite a bit.
I was going to say, I remember that from like one of the movies that she was smoking. Is that true?
That is what they say is true. Her court, they said it was something like she became, I don't want to say addicted to it, but let's just say that it became something that she enjoyed. And if you can imagine the queen smoking tobacco, you know, which seems kind of a lower class thing to do.
Well,
but back then it was so avant-garde.
At that time it was novel.
Yeah. And it built an empire. It was, you know, a cash crop only grown in Virginia.
Yeah, but another thing that kind of struck me as interesting with her is we'll get to alchemy in a second. Sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff
we'll get
about
there.
It, though. But because of the whole Protestant thing, she didn't go to the normal allies, let's say. So she didn't go to France or Spain. In fact, you know, she had wars with France and Spain at various points. So in fact, she went to Morocco at some point, and they had something in common. And then the Ottoman Empire, in one correspondence, Sultan Murad III entertained the notion that Islam and Protestantism had, quote, much more in common than either did with Roman Catholicism, as both rejected the worship of idols. So, I mean, you know, kind of grasping at straws in a way, but still, it's kind of interesting that they're like, hey, you know, here's somebody that's different from the rest of Europe. Let's try to ally ourselves with them. And, you know, so the Sultan argued for an alliance between England and the Ottoman Empire. And they did have, so she started the, what was it? Not, you know, like there's the East India Trading Company. It started something like the Turkish Trading Company. It formerly was known as the Levant Trading Company or something
well,
like
there,
that.
Well, there was the Virginia Trading Company.
Yeah, but that's for
the company,
other direction.
Right, other direction,
yeah.
Right.
And then so there was, for the Ottoman Empire, she created a company or she chartered a company called, like, I think officially it was called the Levant Trading Company or something like that. That dealt with the Ottoman Empire. So, you know, and the rest of Europe, again, was like, this was a scandal because, you know, yeah, how dare you ally yourself with a Muslim country, you know?
Maybe it sounds a little bit like today, like insider trading. You know, I mean, you're basically, you know, attaching yourself to another power to corner the market on the sales of what's going on.
That, and if she didn't ally herself with somebody, you know, eventually France and Spain were going to just march all over her.
Sure.
So this is, you have to realize that time of her death was like 30 years before the 30 Years' War.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
It does, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, so it really, it is that time period when you know, Martin Luther is just about that, you know, a little bit before that time. So it really is that time of Europe when they're all being polarized. This is right, you know, 50 years after Jan Hus and that kind of thing. So, okay, that's great. But let's bring it into alchemy a little bit.
Okay, so you set the table.
Yeah. So
now we're ready to hear.
I think we know who she is.
Okay.
Because I know she is a really obscure figure in history and no one's ever heard of
sure,
her.
Sure, sure.
But now we know. So we obviously mentioned her a lot in the John Dee episode. So if you'd like, you know, listen to that episode, there's a lot more on her. In fact, I think one of the, you know, John Dee episodes is one of my favorites. We were waiting forever, researching forever to get that one just right, the way it turned out. So
John Dee and Edward Kelly when we did those shows.
Yeah, and I think one thing I forgot to say on that show though was that John Dee had a correspondence with Elizabeth I while he was traveling off in Europe, you know, including coming to Prague and stuff. What I failed to mention on that show, I don't think I mentioned it, was that he signed his letters with a code. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Do you know what the code was?
No.
So he had a code name, 007.
Oh, we did say this. Yes, that's right.
I know I've told you this.
Okay, 007.
Like a year ago, but I think we might have not said it on the show though. And so yeah, it was, and it's It's even written in a weird way. You know how John Dee, everything's symbols. But yeah, so John Dee was the first 007.
Do we ever find out exactly why he picked those three? There had to be a reason.
I can't remember.
Because he was putting you know, symbols, symbology all together, yeah. and numbers and things made.
I mean, he wrote it in a weird way. So you have the 00, like two zeros, and then the 7, the upper part of the 7 goes over both zeros. So it does look like a weird symbol kind of weird thing. I mean, it looks like a John Dee kind of thing if you see it written that way. But yeah, he was the first.
And that's how Queen Elizabeth knew it was John Dee's correspondence.
Who knows why he did that. But yeah, John Dee was... That is kind of a good point because John Dee was disliked by a lot of people, even within Elizabeth's court. So yeah, it probably made sense for him to actually go by a pseudonym, you know. So
maybe he was trying to make a picture of an owl.
I think we mentioned this on the John Dee show, but again, 1559, January 15th was the actual coronation date. And that is no coincidence because John Dee carefully picked that date based off of a horoscope he cast for her. So, even her coronation date was, you know, had some astrological and numerological significance there. In 1568, the book Prope Dogmata Aphoristica was actually, you know, so it's about mathematics and astrology and magic, and he actually presented that to Queen Elizabeth, and she was very interested in this kind of thing, which is, hey, that's why we're talking about her, you know. And then I'm sure we mentioned that on the show also, that in 1575, Queen Elizabeth actually went and visited John Dee's library at Mortlake. So, I mean, a royal visit to John Dee's house. And at that time, John Dee actually had the biggest library in her kingdom. So it's not, and it wasn't just about magic and alchemy, but it was, you know, mathematics, and all kind navigation, all kinds of other
stuff.
Here's
the question.
Architecture, I mean.
How do you cater to the Queen of England when she comes to your house? I mean, you serve tea. I mean, what do you do for that? This seems like a lot of prep work.
Bring out your best china and your best Earl Grey. And
it seems a little stressful to me to be entertaining the Queen of England, but...
But I mean, there is a reason why John Dee was in her circles when not that many people liked him. And I mean, you know, there was a lot of people that really, really spoke out against him. But in fact, you know, she didn't just pay him a visit. She actually had her own alchemical manuscripts, and she pored over these for hours. So it's not like she had a collection sitting on her shelf. No, like she actually studied alchemy. In fact, she had her own alchemical lab where she herself ran experiments. So we're not talking like, here's a monarch with an interest in alchemy, so we're going to bring on the show. No. By some definitions, you could call her an alchemist. So she's the real deal. I don't think it's a stretch to bring her. I started reading some of this stuff. I'm like, oh boy. Yeah, she's... If you read about... There's several books that I even have that talk about the Elizabethan era and, or, you know, talk about these occult figures. But no, she played a key role herself. I mean, it is really interesting. So, for instance, some of her personal beliefs. So she believed in Dee's interpretation of celestial signs for telling the coming apocalypse. And we talked about this a little bit on Dee's show. So she also believed that Catholics and Protestants should be reconciled before that happened, like before the apocalypse. And important part for this show is that the Philosopher's Stone and alchemy played a role somehow in the reconciliation. So somehow by finding the Philosopher's Stone, that was kind of the key to everybody would suddenly come to an understanding, you know.
Or more so, trying to heal the rifts that war and antagonism had engulfed both parts of the religion. Yeah, maybe something like that, like the Philosopher's Stone, would be able to mend those problems, right?
And what I think is interesting is you take the normal historic backdrop of, you know, her shaping the Church of England. Now her Church of England is really a compromise. That's the only way to see. If you look at the Anglican Church today, it's a compromise between basically all other Protestant churches and the Catholic Church. And so, you know, that's historical fact. You can walk into any Anglican church and see that it's clearly something in between Catholicism and the rest of Protestantism. And so now you have that backdrop of like, okay, so now you take the belief that she believed that she had to reconcile the churches before the apocalypse, and that the philosopher's key is a key, is a, or philosopher's stone is a key in that, like, that just makes it so much more interesting. So, I mean, yeah, it's just that, yeah, any alchemist fans will appreciate that little tidbit. I mean, I just, you can't look at the Anglican Church the same way anymore. But, you know, there was also more practical reasons.
You know, more so like the early part of Elizabeth's reign, that the crown was very low on money.
Yeah.
Right? The court was intrigued by claims of practical alchemy at the time, because this was a possible cash cow, if they could figure it out. Also, distilling houses during her reign were...
Yeah, that increased a lot. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, Millicent Frankwell distilled in her own privy chamber, if you can imagine that. If we talk about a boom of distillery activities. She was extremely educated in many things, including alchemy, and even challenging professors on her knowledge set.
Yeah. And in fact, when I was looking at alchemists in her court, it's a total who's who. Like, basically every name could be their own show. In fact, if this show exists for long enough, they probably will be, because every, I mean, she really brought a lot of alchemists, not just alchemists, but you know, kind of scientists and people that had really interesting theories to her court, and really heard them out, and didn't just entertain them or you know, have them a part of their court, but she really asked them pointed questions. Like, you know, here's the queen asking you, picking apart your own personal theories, which I thought was interesting. But Abel Fecknam, Thomas Norton, and then under Edward IV, Thomas Charnock was his uncle under Henry VII, T. Charnock, the nephew under Elizabeth. So, you know, you have a kind of families in several of the different king's courts. Cornelius de Lannoy, also known as de Alneto instead of Lannoy. I might have a show on him. He's really interesting. Ioannis Panteos, or Pantura, depending on, you know, what sources you read. Mary Sidney Herbert. And then there was a really interesting character that I really want to do a show on too, is William Medley. He actually turned iron to copper. Really, he did it. It was some kind of alloys, but it really did work. He did a really fun little chemistry experiment, which was, I forget what it, I'll have to do a show on him, but to the people, to the spectators, it looked like alchemy. It was like, so first of all, this is faulty alchemical theory, because you're turning iron to copper. It should be the other way around, but okay, fair enough. So, but yeah, it was, and then Joachim Ganz kind of did the same thing, where... I don't remember what it was now, but it's some kind of alloy, and you put iron in, you mix the alloy with it, and copper comes out. So it was, you know, it would bind. It was some alloy that was bound to the copper, but you put it with iron, it binds more readily with iron. So the iron would seem to go away, and the copper would come out. So to the people observing, it was just like, oh my God, this is alchemy. You know, this is the best proof there is. So, yeah, really interesting stuff, but, you know, it's just a simple chemistry trick, really. But, yeah, another thing is if you have a keen eye and you just go Google image search some portraits of Elizabeth, you see her associated with, like, pelicans or phoenixes, and sometimes you'll see a phoenix in the corner or a pelican hidden somewhere in the portrait.
Interesting. I never noticed that.
That is not an accident. So that, you know, the pelican is an alchemical or even a chemical instrument. You know, it has that neck. It's like an alembic.
An alembic cylinder. And it looks like a distillation. Neck or a swan's neck, right?
And they would call that a pelican, you know.
Okay.
And then a phoenix is, you know, the symbol of the philosopher's stone, you know, being reborn from the ashes, that kind of thing. Or a homunculus, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, phoenix is, you know, that's in alchemical recipes, that's one of the steps is illustrated by a phoenix, because it's, you know, elixir, like we've said 1,000 times before, means from the ashes. But yeah, you burn your ingredients down, you get ashes, you add some mixture. That's exactly, you get your elixir. So yeah, we've talked about that. So look at her portraits a little more carefully. There's like straight up alchemical symbols mixed in there, and not by coincidence. And then, you know, John Prestall was in her circles. That's another interesting character of the time.
So when we talk about all this knowledge set, it's just natural we talk about an academy being a part of all this. And an academy was proposed in London for just the royals, the nobility, and royal servants. Among the usual navigation, math, and other types of things that are taught in a normal academy, alchemy was a part of this curriculum. It was deemed too expensive, but just interesting to note that how mainstream alchemy was kind of making its inroads at the time.
Yeah.
As a science.
Exactly. And we mentioned, like, even later, like Harvard teaching alchemy, you know, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was, I mean, it's too bad it didn't happen. Because, you know, an academy where they just formally taught alchemy, that would be awesome. But another thing I came across, and this is really important if, you know, because you will hear stories of people. So William Medley is the guy that turned iron to copper, right? You will hear people debunking his theories. But get this. So here's something interesting I came across. When Medley was turning iron into copper, he needed an investment. So he did that in front of William Humphrey, who at the time was the warden at the Mint. Later, that same position would be taken by Isaac Newton, by the way. So important position. Now, Humphrey marveled at how he had created more copper than the iron he started with. So Humphrey wrote that the experiment should A, be kept secret, and B, it should be publicly ridiculed and called a failure, right? To keep it secret. So this means that if you read other contemporary criticisms, take those with a grain of salt.
Okay.
Because this was part of a public relations campaign so publicly they debunked William Medley's experiment.
Well, I want you to think about this. It's like supply and demand and the value and devaluation of possible the currency that you're having.
Yeah.
If you wind up actually doing this and
they're you're going to debase copper.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
First of all, keep it secret. And second, let's publicly humiliate this experiment.
This goes back to something I said I know a million times on this show. If there was a person to make gold for, like, you know, King, you know, for Emperor Rudolph. Right.
Yeah.
What would happen to that person? He probably would be killed or imprisoned for the rest of his life to keep that knowledge in one place. Because once anybody could do it, then what would happen to gold as far as its uniqueness?
Yeah.
And everyone would have it. It would decrease
value.
Yeah,
exactly. So there was also some German princes I read came across that would publicly ridicule things and then secretly hire their court alchemists. Another interesting thing. So if you look at it in this kind of occultist sort of context, if you've ever read Edmund Spencer's The Faerie Queen, reread it knowing what I just said. So it's full of alchemical symbols and this kind of thing. And it's talking about Elizabeth and it's talking about her being a sort of mystical being, you know, the Faerie Queen. It's about her. But if you read it in that light, you're like, oh, that's interesting. So I was reading some excerpts about it. And reading a kind of a commentary on the poem, and I was like, okay, yeah, it's just really interesting stuff. I'm sure a lot of people, if you ever studied literature or something, you've come across Edmund Spencer. Like, he's really famous for the time. But yeah, so you know, another interesting kind of occultist or alchemist take on a common poem, let's say. Another interesting thing is that she may have even played a role in Roger Bacon's early education, who we did a show on. So, her influence could be felt far and wide, but not just politically and all that stuff, but also within alchemy.
So we did a show on the Swedish Queen Christina that was very much involved in alchemy and following things through, because even though the rest of her court was against her following this kind of what they would consider, you know, dark knowledge set, that she still followed through with it, and it was kind of a place for alchemists to come for a safe harbor in the north in Scandinavia. We all, of course, know what it was like here in Prague to a certain time, that it was a haven that alchemists could come here and do their research. But Queen Elizabeth also was a patron of this particular art. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we really want to send home to the point tonight in tonight's episode, because we also know that she was an extremely important and influential figure when it talks about exploration, defending the realm, you know, during the age of the split between the Catholics and Protestants of church. So, you know, it just adds one more bit of information that she is also a person that was very close to alchemy and allowed people such as John Dee to have some kind of influence on her life.
Yeah, because exactly. I mean, when she passed, and it was, who was the next king, Edward or something? In Edward's time, a lot of people kind of had to skip town or watch their necks, because suddenly, yeah, that was not seen as something you could do.
There was no more openly, safe haven in London.
Yeah,
no.
So, but yeah, anyways, you know, distillation experiments in royal privy chambers, that definitely warrants a spot on the show.
I think right? so, right?
Yeah, whatever that means. But yeah, so, I mean, yeah, after her death, she was praised as a heroine of the Protestant cause and also, you know, a ruler of a golden age. So after her death, her kind of reputation even increased, I would say. And often, I mean, for hundreds of years, even in the 20th century, at in times of need, like in war, people would remember the miracle of the Spanish Armada and that kind of thing. And people would kind of recall the memory of Elizabeth I. So clearly she, you know, if you can name 10 British monarchs, she's one of them.
She's got to be.
You know.
Absolutely.
So anyways, another royal alchemist.
So Travis, we got a lot of changes coming up on the show.
Yeah, we do.
You're fired. You want to talk about that? Okay, well, that's going to happen.
Yeah, so if you guys don't hear from me, so yeah, so I'm moving from Prague to California.
What?
Where there are less alchemists, unfortunately.
We kind of talked about this before the show. Yeah, California.
Well, this is awkward, you hearing about it now.
I'm your co-host. What's going on?
What's
going to happen to me?
So the show will go on. Don't worry about that. But during the transition period, you might not hear from me every couple of weeks. It might be a month or maybe even, you know, 6 weeks between shows until I get up and going again. And we'll have to, you know, figure out how to record remotely. So, I mean, I've done that with interviews before.
And it's about a 9-hour difference
between Prague. But it's a 9-hour time difference.
In Santa Clara.
The show will go on. Great. We've decided. We're going to be stubborn about it. We're not going to cancel that easily.
Well, we got like 9 shows, right? So 9 different programs that we do together.
At least some of them will go on. I think Bohemian is optional.
I think that's the wrong way to approach this because Bohemian is a great show. It's a great show.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what show would have a person from California and Prague talk about Czech history?
Define great.
Right?
Define great. Because if you define it as like mediocre-ish,
we have some very loyal followers.
You look angry, Coleman.
We have some very loyal followers, and we will continue the show.
Yeah.
You know, moving forward,
I like the Bohemian followers. Actually, the Bohemian listeners are a great crowd. All three of them.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. But you know, moving forward, you know, Travis and I have discussed. We've had some a summit, if you will, about where we want to go with these shows, and I think that it will continue. We're going to be doing a lot of recording and script writing and research before Travis heads out off to the new world, to the West Coast, the Best Coast, and we'll see what happens.
Now I'll be doing my script writing on a beach instead of in the rain. But
yeah, you do your thing, Coleman. Yeah, I gotcha.
But you just, you know, no, we're going to get nice here too.
Yeah, we're going to hear a lot of stuff about palm trees and Route 1 driving to work. So, yeah, that's great. But, you know, it's going to be interesting because we're going to have this, you know, in two different countries, still be able to kind of perform what we're doing. I think there's still a lot more stories to talk about with Alchemy. There's a lot more stories to talk about with the Bohemian podcast. And, of course, you're going to continue your German podcast as well.
Oh, yeah. Those are still happening.
So there's a lot of things going on. We're going to do our best to kind of make sure that void, there's no real gap in that in this transition. Before we get back together via the
time
difference.
Try our best. Still yeah. The main point is, if there is a gap, don't give up. Don't unsubscribe. We will be back. So, that's a big move. So I might, I want to know if I'll have my microphone for a month or so. So we'll have
to. Well, we're going
to
be recording during the holidays. Yeah, so yeah. We're going to do a lot of recording during the holidays. So be ready for that. And we hope you stick with us.
Yep. So thanks for listening.
Alchemy's awesome. I don't know. I feel awkward.
I got confused.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, other episodes, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter. @AlchemyPodcast. Tune into our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.